of Swami Saraswati Nityananda. Swami.
Thank you, Mr. Stroh. Before we start, let us calibrate our minds. Thank you. Tonight we're discussing one of the most important aspects of the spiritual life. I think it's the most important because it's the basis of realization, and that is devotion. Many techniques can be taught about realization, and long hours can be spent in trying to acquire it. But there is no technique for devotion. Devotion is simply love. Master Jesus' whole mission was one of love. It is the mission of devotion. We cannot really enter a state of complete oneness with life until we understand love not merely as something we give and expect from others, but as a whole integral process of becoming love itself. It is a way in which we are transformed by some form of dedication, commitment, and action. These three things are part of love. Dedication, commitment, action. Jesus said to his disciples, "Love ye one another." That is a commitment. A dedication: when two or three are gathered in my name, there am I in the midst. An action: go ye unto the nations, spread the word. Live it. This is devotion. This is realization. This is the living vitality of the spirit. Two or three getting together amplifies the spirit. Loving one another is touching each other immediately. The fear of another person kills love, kills realization, kills devotion. If we are not afraid to touch, we will never cease to realize ourselves. But once we are afraid to touch, realization will die out in us. If we are afraid to get together, to face each other in a room, two or three, in a common issue, realization will die out. The common bond is to face one another. Going among the nations, trying to be in union with them, this is the action. This is the realization on a total existence. Life with all beings, wherever they are, you are part of it. You are thrilling, vibrating, becoming one. No technique is needed for this. Devotion is simply living. I cannot emphasize it too much because I know it may sound like a divine madness. But I'd rather be on the side of divine madness than no madness at all. It is the only madness I know that has value. Devotion. We often want some personal aspect of God to tell ourselves we have to be devoted. But if we don't have some personal aspect to relate to, we would not know what to generate in our devotion. If I don't see God in some physical aspect, I would not know the basic qualities of my human body. I cannot experience love on an intimate basis. The Master Jesus was a human being. It required a human form to generate intimacy. Years ago, when I saw his figure, I hated it because I did not understand what intimacy meant. I grew up trying to be a Catholic priest and found myself straying way away from the reality of what it meant. I saw brothers and sisters kneeling and praying before statues, and I said in my mind, bunch of idol worshippers. I began to study Oriental teachings, thinking I was wiser than them. Ended up, they're the biggest idol worshippers. I come back today and I find myself, I'm a super idol worshipper. I carry them around with me. Truly, how can we ever really experience love if we don't have intimacy? A man loves his wife because that's intimate to him. A woman loves her husband because that's intimate to her. Man and God must come on an intimate basis because devotion is centered in that. When two or three are gathered in my name, again, that is the centering point. Love ye one another, intimacy. Go unto the nations, intimacy. Can we escape devotion? Do we need techniques to be exclusive or isolated from others? No, we can't. It's not possible. I cannot tell you how I can escape being involved with you. I may tell you, you can escape me, because you can go where you want to go. But out of sight is not out of mind. You are with me. So devotion is my life. It is the key of realization, and realization is to make real, to make tangible, to make active. If nothing is real or active to you, you don't have anything. It's wishing, it's wanting, craving, not really getting down to the reality of experience. Devotion must give you experience on a basis in which you must be part of everything that is going on, not isolating yourself, not shutting out, not denying. Is being more amenable, more applicable, more involved, because you want to see this reality. The disciples of Jesus and all the disciples of great teachers found this out to be the only safe platform for a spiritual life. I use the word safe. It's when something is safe, there's a sense of insurance locked up in it. You know, we buy an automobile, but we are not too safe until we insure it. Equally true, we take out life into this physical mechanism, but we don't feel too safe in it until some assurance or insurance or relationship to God in some form. The Hindus want their Krishna. The Christians want Jesus. The Buddhists want their Buddha. Man wants God in the form of man. This is the real assurance. We are praying for another coming of Christ. Are we praying for an electrical form, an ideational form, or are we praying for another human form? An animal wouldn't satisfy us. A tree won't. A plant won't. A mineral wouldn't. Human form. Why human form? It is the challenge. The greatest challenge, that you can look at human form and say, truly, this is divinity. This is a possibility that we, in human form, can relate by intimacy, by bond of common touch. Mary wants the common touch at the feet of her master. Many disciples want the common touch of their masters or their teachers. The common touch is devotion. It's the opening up of the heart so great that there is no boundary lines no more. Everything fades in this oneness. You and I, reach out in many ways, present in the body, present in the mind, present in the spirit, by letters, by telephone, we reach out, we communicate, we are identified. Devotion is that key. Devotion is that bond. Yet, devotion must go deeper than just that. It must go to the bonds of silence, the intimacy of silence with yourself. Because God is not only personal, He is impersonal. And the impersonalness of God is the bond of silence, the dedication to silence, a research into the silence of your nature. This research into your own nature makes it possible now to reach out beyond the boundary lines of human contact into the superhuman contact. This superhuman contact requires self-chosen seclusion. That is a price we have to pay for devotion. Moments of withdrawal from our fellow men in order to gain inner strength. This type of devotion may seem erratic at times. It may seem detrimental to family life, detrimental to social life, detrimental even to national life. But yet, it is highly important that all men look inside for this intimacy of the divine. No one can give it to you. You can only give it to yourself. So, more and more, as man reaches out for the intimacy of God within himself, he will seek the inner solitude as a means to raise this devotion. Getting together on global scale or national scale or group friends, this again is that intimacy of silence. In some countries, even this country, there used to be days of silence or moments of silence. I remember when I was a boy, on the day when 11th of November came around, they said it was a moment of silence, and the whole country got silent for a few minutes. It always puzzled me, while listening to that intense silence, it would seem like all the minds of the people were clicking away, like the keys of a typewriter. No one was talking, yet I seemed to sense their minds clicking away like a typewriter in the back of my mind. And I often wondered what it meant. What was it? What type of communication was going on? Years after, I realized there was a deep inner communication, a deep inner bond going on, a bond of remembrance with those who have passed on. If we can extend this research now into daily life and reach into it, we can bring about greater realization and a greater bond of the spirit. Devotion is not an outward motion only. It's an inward motion. It's an inward motion that requires some degree of time to be aware of yourself. And we find this is possible in the churches. The churches were built around us to give us that time for devotion. We come into the church, we get into the atmosphere, we are reminded of its importance, its purpose, and we are suddenly pulled in by association. But we don't extend this boundary line of association. We don't increase the intensity of the silence within ourselves. We don't bring it to fruition with a direct experience with beings who exist in the silence, who exist in the very actual structure of creation. You may call them saints, angels, or divine beings. They are there. They are around us. When we are aware of them and we make the attempt true devotion to identify or connect with them, then we too have a greater realization and the part we play in our existence. If we don't understand that, and if we don't have the opportunity in the church to practice it, then we have to apply it on our own initiative. We must apply our own initiative to get it. That's why Jesus emphasized the fact, when two or three are gathered in my name. Now, we can contact Jesus. He did not say it was impossible. He said it was possible if you get together and lock in on an intimacy basis, internally within yourself, and bring about this experience for your own self. In the Eastern country, the science of the soul has laid this out as a way in which we can make this contact. They did not even generate any technique for devotion. They started out by simply saying, find yourself a spot, close your eyes, and take your ideal with you within. Now, Buddhists will see Buddha. Christians will see Christ. Hindus will see Krishna. Mohammedans will see Muhammad. Other religions will see their great patron saint, even Saint Patrick. So take your ideal within you and look in. This is the bond of intimacy from within. The saint has lived his life by trying out many techniques. Finally, too, he became technique-less by becoming devotion. Then members of the human race remember him and take him to heart. So the saint lives on in the minds of men. Devotion can continue within us if we take the ideal that is great, important to us, and cause it to come alive for the first time inside. Taking that ideal and bringing it alive and nourishing it every day is reality, is realization. You are in doubt that this can do something for you? Don't doubt it. That ideal, that particular form, will follow you all the way to all the levels of consciousness. It will pull you up to any level that you are capable of going. And that ideal, again, will make you see yourself within that ideal. And finally, the ideal will be you. Your own internal experience of devotion comes from a conquest of the mind by the spirit of love. You will conquer the mind through the spirit of love, and by facing the ideal moment to moment within yourself in consciousness, and then you will realize the reality of an inner communion with the spirit. There is no greater conquest of the mind by love. I have tried many techniques, and I tell you the honest truth, the easiest technique, which is not a technique, is simply love. To generate this devotional love, I found sound, music, to be the key. Because I am sound, I am a crystallized form of sound. Through chanting, the devotional nature is raised up. It brings us into an inner bond with ourselves. Why? It's easy for you to be Caruso in the bathtub, or take off on a Pagliacci or something, and let go of all the inhibitions within yourself. But the moment you let go of something, you're entering a state of realization of something else. So you see, devotion has no technique. It simply allows you to become the ideal. You can become the ideal, the master, by simple love to him within yourself. I've heard many chants in my studies, and there is one chant which I'm very fond of, that generates the greatest devotion to the Master. If you'd like to join me, we can go into it. Om Christ, Om Christ, Om Christ, Om. 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 Om Christ, come Christ, come Christ, come. Come 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 Christ, come Christ, come Christ, come. Om Christ, Om Christ, Om Christ, Om. 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 Come Christ, come Christ, come Christ, come. 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 Om Christ, Om Christ, Om Christ, Om. 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 Om Christ, Om Christ, Om Christ, Om.
Om Christ.
Devotion is intimacy, and feeling is intimacy. And feeling the presence of the Christ surrounding you in a blue light, and feeling that presence permeating you, your love spreads out through all the pores into the room, into the walls of this building, into the very city, to every home in this community. You are feeling more than any time you can feel, and that is now. At this very moment, you're feeling the most. You're feeling the oneness of the Spirit. The calmness of the mind is the love and the devotion that is becoming real in a tangible way, keeping the body very calm, very relaxed, very serene. All inner hostilities are flowed out, and the sense of oneness, the sense of the presence of the Christ, permeates us all. And that permeation of peace, that precipitation of the peace, will flow out through our eyes as we open them gradually. How long you hold on to that precipitation, this is the measurement of your realization. The great sage Sri Yukteswar said, realization or spiritual advancement is measured by the depth of your peace in the waking state after meditation or after a devotional chant. Anytime you can come out and maintain that peace, maintain that inner composure in the waking state, you have raised the stature, you have enlarged the boundary line of your realization. One may not see anything strange or new about the realization. Rest assured that this sudden electrical tingling sensation that is passing through your body has a magnetic quality to directly affect the environment. And if you maintain the inner composure while handling your business affairs, you will see some strange miracles occurring in your life. The things you thought not possible suddenly falling into place. Life seems to fit, and you seem to fit into your body for the first time. You know, many of us are alien to our bodies, but devotion is that experience that allows us to fit into our bodies for the first time. It's a sense of oneness. Going deeper into devotion, depends upon repetition. The more we are devoted, the more we want to repeat the process. The more we want to feel the love. Now this may seem monotonous, that you have to keep repeating it. But if you ask yourself, when a person loves someone, doesn't he not or she see that individual in their mind night and day? Don't they keep thinking of that person in their minds night and day? The impression is so strong. And if the impression is so strong, it is fed by repetition. Devotion is that same principle. When we see the Christ ideal or the Buddha ideal or the Krishna ideal or the Muhammad ideal, whatever the ideal is within the mind, and we feed it or nurture it by repetition, it becomes ourselves. At a certain level of your devotion, when you're within yourself in meditation and you have to cross certain mental boundary lines or levels of consciousness, it is that ideal that's within you that will allow you to go past those boundary lines. The masters or the ideals are the way sure. They go ahead of you. They travel inward ahead of you in consciousness. It is their vibratory rate, their devotional control, that helps you to overcome your inner hostilities, your inner tensions, your inner anxieties. By relating to one of them, or any amount of them, or all of them, you can go through your inner consciousness without being torn down by any of these mental conditions or hostilities. Many of us may not want to associate with an ideal in devotion and feel that I am a human being, I am the ideal, how do I relate now? All right. Such a type of devotion would indicate that you have to look at this body as a temple. And this temple has certain centers. And these centers either act negatively or positively in terms of attitude. The ideal attitude, how many of us know what it is? But the wrong attitudes, a great many of us are familiar with, because we've had too many conflicts due to the wrong attitudes. If we don't know what the ideal attitude is inside, in the centers, how can we cause them to come forward, to transform us? How can we make this a reality? How would devotion suddenly release it? We don't know. We would be constantly assuming that we have the right attitude. We are constantly assuming that we have the right ideal from inside. We have to relate to someone, some physical form that has applied the right ideal to give us some sense of calibration, some sense of direction. For Christians, we need Jesus. For Buddha, we need the Buddhist. For Buddhists, we need Buddha or Krishna or any one of the great teachers. Each man in his own ethnic background must have some ideal to relate to. So it is not wrong to start out with the ideal and then try to go through the centers, feeling their release within you. The centers are there within you, and we are going to have to pass through those centers in our deepest devotions. Without an ideal to guide us, passing through that experience can be called the night of the soul. It's a term used by a great saint who had every type of nightmare, mental anguish, turmoil, trying to go through by himself in the early stages of his growth. When he decided to take the ideal with him along, then the nightmares begin to diminish. The problems of the inner life begin to disappear. Years ago, when I was practicing meditation, I too did not want an ideal, because I cannot see the possibility of wanting to relate to an idol or a form. But all my researches have brought me back to my highest experience in devotion to an ideal. Because the human mind does not know what the true ideal is, unless the human mind can relate to some form or being who lives the ideal. Therefore, I accept every saint, sage, God-realized man to be an ideal, because each one, either in the body or out of the body or yet to be born, are all living the simple principle of devotion. Last year I met a Swami from India. His name was Muktananda. He did not say much in our presence, but whatever he said was an indication of a tremendous lesson in devotion. He said, "Grace of Guru." Those three words made all the difference. To some people, it made nothing at all, no impression. When I read his autobiography not too long ago, published, when he started out to meditate, he only met his teacher once. And after many years of research in all the levels of the chakras, all the way up in the inner consciousness, the form that was most rewarding to him in his moments of spiritual nightmares, anguish, the only form that was really comforting to him was the teacher. And when he went to the highest point possible to really break the bubble of illusion, who did he see greeting him? The form of his teacher. This is true. You take the ideal, be it Jesus or any one of the great teachers, and go all the way in, relating, loving, they will meet you all the way to the highest point when you break the illusion, and you will see that that ideal is there. And the lesson you will learn from the ideal is God and the ideal are one. When Jesus said, "I and my Father are one," he spoke the highest realization founded on devotion. When you see yourself within the divinity, and see yourself as the divinity. Now that is the ideal form. You have come to that realization based upon your devotion. The form of a great sage or saint helps you to raise your devotion to be like the saint. Then eventually, you and this creative principle must become one. You and the Father must become one. The devotion must culminate in this final realization that you and the Father are one. Jesus told his disciples, "Call no man master, save the Lord that is within thee. And therefore I call you no longer my disciples, but my friends." He too would not want you, at the highest point of realization, to accept his physical form as a limitation upon yourself. But he would feel honored if you use his image as a guideline towards your own realization, founded on the devotion within yourself. I heard one time a great doctor, his name was Dr. Cooley, the second best, they may call him the best today, in heart surgery. He was a student of another doctor who was the leading specialist in Texas. And he made a statement. He said, "If you want to be the best, imitate the next best. And when you have imitated it long enough, try to originate." What is he saying? He's saying identically the same thing. Start out with the ideal, work to the point when you and the principle become one. You are projecting for yourself. Jesus said the same thing. Many received him, as many would accept the ideal. To them gave he the devotion, or the power to stick with it. You have to stick with it inside. And each one of us will become identified in the creative principle, sons of God. Each one of you would now see yourself identified in God. And that is the realization. The realization that is based on devotion and accepting some ideal as a guideline. It simplifies for many people who are caught up in the conflict of what to do to realize themselves. When we remove the conflicts that impede us in realizing ourselves and take an ideal simply on the foundation of love, we will then realize our own selves immersed in that truth. There was a Catholic saint by the name of Catherine. She started out her meditations and her devotions not wanting to see anything but the true form of God. At first I said, "Here I have found someone like me." I read and I read and I read, and then when she had seen all these different forms and she kept pushing them away more and more, till she reached what is called in Nightmare of the Soul, or the Dark Night of the Soul. One day, just about dawn, she had the experience of seeing Catherine herself in the light. She could not understand why she was looking at her own self. She thought she had an out-of-body experience. In this consciousness, said and related to her, "You and I are one." No, this is too much. And she tried to shut it out. But as every time she shut it out, the form was there. Finally, she broke down into devotion and accepted that when the Lord wants you to see the truth about yourself, there is nothing you can do but accept. Yogananda had the same type of experience. He searched by looking into the sky everywhere for the ideal form. He loved Jesus, he loved Buddha and all of them. And he kept searching for the form, maintaining his devotion. Finally, when the true experience came and the light broke open upon him, this is what he heard within the light. "Hello, playmate. You and I are one." There was no more fear. The realization brought to him now, out of the devotion, the reality about himself. Jesus accepted it. He came back, he told men that this is what man has to face. "I and the Father are one. You see me, you see the Father. Look at yourself, and when you get the realization based upon the devotion, you will know this beyond all doubt, and that you are free." Now don't judge yourself after the realization come that you may be incompetent of performing miracles. That is not what is intended. The true realization of yourself based upon devotion is peace. Peace that passes all understanding. The magnitude of this peace, you couldn't begin to comprehend it, even if you try. There is no way to relate this peace. In the most difficult moments of your life, when everything is crashing around you, this peace seems to sustain you. Even if you have the power to stop the ocean, stop a mad elephant in its track, or stop your train in its track, still this peace would supersede it. And you would have to use the word peace, be still. The waves were crashing in on the little ship that the disciples were living in or fishing. And when they were in a state of panic, they called upon their ideal. Why? Because they were afraid. And even when the master awoke and looked, what did he say? "Peace, be still." The power of realization, when fully precipitated into the body, is peace. This is true realization based on devotion. Thank you.
We will have 5-minute break, and then O'Donnell will be answering questions.
I said before, the ideal of all beliefs all bring you to the same experience, oneness with the Spirit. But that is where our journey begins. It doesn't end there. Devotion begins now to have value when you are one with the Spirit. Many of us think that after our ideal has brought us to oneness with the Spirit, the job is over. No. The job is not over. The job has now begun for man. Man has to involve himself with his fellow man on a global nature, on a universal nature. He has to work with this oneness of the Spirit. It is only by taking up the greater commitment, the greater challenge of life, that the oneness of Spirit has meaning. If when Jesus or Buddha and all these men found the oneness of the Spirit in themselves and remained in the mountain caves, isolated themselves from society, would you know of them? Would you ever hear of them? Not possible. It is only because they took upon themselves to get involved on a global nature, a universal nature, that their impact had value. Each one of us is moving towards that identification of the Spirit. And when that occurs in all of us, then each one of us from that time must get involved. The Spirit will have to move you forward to be involved with others. This is the challenge, and this is the greater realization, the involvement with mankind as a whole. We don't know how this involvement will affect society in years to come. But since we are accepting that this is going to be the Aquarian age, an age of unfoldment, an age of enlightenment, it is the age of participation. As we become identified with the Spirit, we are going to be forced to demonstrate the Spirit by being human beings for the first time and respecting another human being. And within your own consciousness, you can say, of all the marvels that you have seen, there's nothing to compare with a human being. Because the true human being is one with the Spirit. He is devoid of all gross, all negativeness, all impurities. I remember reading one time Abraham Lincoln saying, I would like at least to see one human being. And when looking out over the White House, a man was passing just about that time along the walkway. No one knew who he was, but it later turned out at that time when Lincoln said it, the man was Walt Whitman walking past the White House. Those who have read The Leaves of Grass know that Mr. Whitman was in a full state of cosmic consciousness. He lived and died in this country, a marvelous human being. And he said, I go on, and I hope that the great saints and sages will look down upon me and think if I'm worthy to be among them. He also realized what it is to be one with the Spirit. He involved himself in his writing. Wherever you involve yourself, after you identify with the Spirit, this would be your great contribution to the world around you, no matter what it is. If there's any questions you want to ask, I'd be glad to answer them now. Yes?
I want to ask about the picture.
All right. In 1963, there was in Yucatan a church, and the people there were praying on a Good Friday. And they reasoned, like everyone else, if Thomas can see the body of Jesus, and if the body of Jesus is genuine, why can they not see it themselves? Since he didn't go any place but remained here in the universal creation. And the priest was very factual too, since he was dealing with very factual people. He said, if you have the devotion, he will come. So they decided to ramp up a good devotion that Sunday, or that Good Friday. And they worked at it. And if, to their amazement, there was a light right in the middle of the church, and there stood the master fully from head to toe. And there was a German man, a baron, I understood. He and his son was in the church at the time. And the son had a camera. And he snapped the picture. Well, the original picture is about this size. I was fortunate to get the enlargement through a friend that knew them all the way. So I have a copy of it. But this is a fulfillment, again, of a very greedy wish. You see, years ago, I did not want to keep a picture of the master because it was painted by other human beings. I didn't want to carry a painting, let alone be attached to it. The only painting that did some stirrings in my heart was the head of Hoffman. But I never latched onto one. I always wanted to know if it's possible to have a photograph. And I've seen even photographs that where the apparent face of Jesus was on the snow, and some Chinese newspaper fellow during the war had photographed it, this face appearing in the snow. Even some artist, aviator in fact, who was flying in the air and saw this light and photographed it, it turned out to be the face of Jesus. Even that I didn't consider worth to carry. But when this came my way, I said, now you keep your big mouth shut. So I have to live with it. Yes. And leave? No. You can have miracle and the powers to perform it, and that can leave you if you have a blow on the head. But the inner peace is rooted in the atomic structure of your nature, right into the cells itself. Well, the first evidence of the inner peace is a gradual shedding of the grossness of the physical body. The body becomes soft and smooth. It becomes like a velvety feeling. You begin to notice this transformation occurring in the cells. And you begin to notice that the hostility of the mind is going out. It's an inner peace that is brought about within the cellular structure. So that when you have it completely, you can be 100 years of age and have a physical body under medical examination equivalent to a baby. We're talking of that kind of peace. Not too long ago, I was fortunate to meet a man, give and take a few years, they say he's 150, but I say 100. And he was examined by an American doctor, and the doctor is amazed that this man's body, function, skin, texture and everything, is like a little child. And he does radiate this peace. So we're talking of an inner peace brought about by a biological transformation. If it's psychological, it'll go away. Yes.
Swami, you mentioned the feeling of electrical vibrations entering in the body.
Yes.
Can you explain what this is?
God is life. And life is energy. Now, how would you experience energy? What would be the sensation? You're familiar with energy in the form of electricity, right? Now, how would you know it's really electricity? The best test is to put your finger in the socket. What would it feel like? Huh? A tingling shock? Well, those who have had any type of spiritual healing will tell you their whole body quivers. Sometimes they're knocked out cold with it. So, we don't want to lose our composure and in a group meeting or go off into some frenzy or hysteria. So the mere fact that you can feel this electrical impulse, which is life pulsating and passing through, is an indication to you that you're on the wavelength of that divine current. Now it's a matter of identifying and living with it consciously, then as you live with it consciously, your whole body will be vibrating with it all the time. Now, when the Holy Spirit descended upon the 12 disciples, or the 11 at the time, they also felt this wave of current in their bodies. And I've seen Pentecostal conversion. It's a wave that comes right through. I met a woman one time, she was a nurse, and she was baptized by the Holy Spirit through Pentecostal. And she went on to do more studies in spiritual life until she was ready for initiation. And the night we were initiating her, When I touched her, she almost went into this state again. But because of her pride and the people in the room, she held on and refused to go into the state. When she was all over, she said to me, "You know, I could have gone back again, talking in tongues, because it was the same feeling, but I didn't want to make myself look like a fool in front of everybody, so I held on and started to bite my teeth, squirm in my shoes, so that I wouldn't have the sensation, and then it stopped." I said, "Oh, you foolish woman. When the Lord wants to give you his joy, why you block it? This was only a confirmation of having it here or having it on the Pentecostal experience, the fact that spirit is spirit." I said, "You might have blocked out a marvelous experience or a communication or some message for many people who might have needed that message simply because of your pride and being afraid to go through the experience." So I says, "Next time when you're having some gift from God, don't block it." But she describes it just as an electrical wave. Yes. The saliva in the mouth. If you have a blow on that spot, there's a shock there. And if you take the tongue and pass it over that spot or the saliva, it will start to alleviate. And the electrical polarity will start a release. Gradually, there is some form of electrolytic action occurring in that spot. Now, you notice little children, when they bang their knees, mother comes over and rubs it and then does something like that, and baby is all right. All right, don't you see animals doing the same thing too? They lick their wound in some form. The saliva is medicinal in some form, and it does neutralize. Let's see how the saliva is very potent in a realized person. There was a blind man that was brought to Jesus, and he spit on the ground. Now you imagine you standing there and looking at him, this, and let's say you're a Greek centurion or a Roman centurion, and all the rest are all native Hebrew people. And being a man of authority, looking at this exhibition of saliva being spit in the ground, take his finger and dwell with it and make a putty and stick it on a man's eye. And then the guy's eyes open up. You'd say to yourself, how crude, how uncouth, dirtiness, but heal. I heard an interesting statement made to a young man by a certain teacher. He went to this man and asked for a healing. You know what the man told him to get? He says, "You get yourself some pigeons and get the hot blood and squirt it in your back, and you'll be well." Now this is a modern city where this information was given to the man. But the man didn't attempt it yet. You see? Now imagine if someone went to Mr. Casey when he was having his readings, and then he was told by him, "Well, I tell you what, get your mother to spit in the ground and massage your back." You may say, what's wrong with Mr. Casey? But certain things do require the most unorthodox ways of getting it done. All right, in the case of Sri Yukteswar and his teacher, Sri Yukteswar went to his teacher and told his teacher that a brother disciple is dying. We need your help. So the teacher looked at him and says, he will be well, he will be well. The doctors are doing their job. He will be well. So he went back. And when he went back, the man was almost dead, and the doctor says, there's nothing we can do for him. Your friend will be dead in a few minutes. So the man died, and Sri Yukteswar was torn up. He went to see his teacher, and he blurted out his information. He says, see, I came to you and I asked for help, and now the man is dead. What good is it? So the teacher says, I didn't know you wanted something from me specifically. All right, I told you you would be well, but I didn't understand you. I'll tell you what you do. You take that castor oil over there and go put 7 drops in his mouth. He'll come back alive. So Sri Yukteswar look at castor oil. And you know, according to Casey, you can put it in your tummy and put some heat packs. Well, here's somebody telling him to go put 7 drops in the dead man's mouth. He takes the 7 drops and puts it in the dead man's mouth. The man gets up. And he goes and sees Sri Yukteswar. And he goes and sees the teacher, Sri Yukteswar. Well, Sri Yukteswar is puzzled. He says, how come 7 drops of castor oil did that? So the teacher said, in the future now, anytime you see a dead man, just put 7 drops of castor oil in his mouth. As if 7 drops of castor oil would immediately heal him. When certain unusual techniques are given by people for certain conditions, it is simply to establish a link. But magnetically speaking and electrically speaking, the saliva can release tension and at the same time can heal a wound. I've seen it done, and so I know it does heal the wound. Yes.
Is that why your mouth feels electrified sometimes with saliva, or is that mm-hmm. a deficiency
of... No, if you... Well, in certain states of meditation, your mouth does feel like an electrical charge inside, and the saliva feels very thick. Mm-hmm. And if you keep on meditating, the saliva becomes now very sweet. Yes, it becomes sweet after a long period of meditation. And this sweetness is exactly like the nectar from a flower. Now, you know, in the ancient days, they said the Greeks lived on nectar or ambrosia, the gods. So, and the Greek gods were living on it. Now, let's look at it in terms of a man who has attained realization by the method of love, devotion, or meditation. This nectar will flow down. It's within the brain. It comes down into the mouth, and you can experience it. Now, they say when you die, you will go to the land of where? Milk and honey, pretty sticky. But this is what they say in your scriptures. You want to die to go to the land of milk and honey. But we have to look at that symbology very clearly in terms of healing. When we die to the senses within this mechanism, our consciousness is drawn up to the pineal gland. And in the pineal gland, there is a viscous substance just like honey, with the color of honey and the taste of honey that is secreted by the gland. And in the medulla, there is a white liquid, the color of milk, the texture of milk. These two combine now and flow down. When they flow down, the body is nourished. Those yogis or saints who have practiced the holy breath long enough to trigger it off can then live without eating. They may eat or they may not eat, or they may just continue their lives with just drinking a little water or liquid to stay in the body to show you that they are here and they exist. Now Jesus said, I have meat that you know not of. He also knew how to tap this energy down and bring it down. And it's all locked up in the saliva too. Now we know in the saliva there are certain properties, enzymes in them that breaks down substances. Yet we don't know enough of the enzymes what it will do. We only know of what appears to be happening when food goes in. If there is no food in the system, the enzymes have a different work to do. Instead of breaking down food for energy now, they begin to release energy. But then we will need an experiment to verify that. The enzymes will begin to feed you now. They will start emitting a different chemical into the body to feed you. Whatever they will do on a physical level, they can do on an extrasensory level. It's all locked up in there. The same body odor that is in reverse action of devotion. Now, if you're in a state of anger or tension, they say the body odor is very foul, right? You know those advertisements, the only reason you need ban is because you got tension. And that's a body odor deodorant, you know. All right, it's because you have tension. No tension, how would the body odor be? It should be sweet, clean. If there is no impurities in this mechanism as a human being, the glandular system will secrete the opposite. Just as much as your endocrine system will secrete certain chemicals to generate hostility, they can now secrete chemicals to generate the opposite of hostility. The saliva is the same. If you know that this person is injured and you can concentrate and release the saliva, you can do something with it. It has a certain magnetic charge that will work. Yes.
Swami, you mentioned to meditate upon a form of God that you hold dear.
Yes.
You mentioned the Christians have Christ.
Yes.
The Hindus have Krishna.
Yes.
What form of God should a person of the Jewish faith meditate upon, which holds God as formless?
If you go back to the Talmud, it tells you, no man has seen God but his what? Light. Man has seen the light of God. Now in the early days, when they were carrying the ark, and around the ark they saw a light like a cloud surrounding the ark, and that was tell the people that God was present. Now, the Hindus also believe just like the Hebrew people. Some of them don't want any form of God, but they all admit, whoever they are, the formless God is light. Now, let's look at the man Jesus. He tried to remove the glorification of his body by saying, when thine eyes are single, your whole body is full of light. Meditation is to focus the eyes or to steady the mind in order to see light. Einstein comes along and says, this is light, atomic energy, matter. Matter is equal to the mass times the velocity of light squared. Energy, is it? Energy is equal to this mass times the velocity of light squared. Light. Atomic light. So when you close your eyes, light is there. Now Jesus is giving us the indication of what is happening inside. If you don't want the form, and when you see your higher self, you will see light. This form is there too. The light is there, and the light is shining in the darkness. That means God's light, which is its true nature, is already shining within you, the darkness of the brain. And the darkness comprehends it not. The five senses does not understand why there should be light in the brain. But if you doubt in your mind that there is any light in your brain, it's very easy to convince yourself by giving you a karate chop on the nostril, and you see the light pretty fast. So that is the evidence on a physical level that light is there. But let your light so shine before men that they may see the good works now and glorify the Father which is in thee. The Father in thee is the light, the total structure of this mechanism. On a conscious level, when you close your eyes, you see some vague movement of a light or a color in there. Not conscious of what it represents, you pay no attention to it. When the mind is steady enough to look at it objectively, without fear, then you and the light become one. Now, if you and the light become one, what would be the obvious picture you would see in the end? You will see yourself. You are made in the image of that light. And if you look at your image, your true self is for the first time looking at yourself. Then you can say without doubt, I and my Father are one. That is the ideal image in the end. Now, the Hebrew and many Hindus start off worshipping God as light, finally coming to the full realization and shouting to the top of the head, I and my Father are one. Eventually, Moses had to experience that. Moses said he saw a burning bush. What is a burning bush? It's a light. This was the only symbology they could relate. He closed his eyes and saw this light burning from here in the Ajna Center, or the third eye center. And as he saw the light inside, he constantly meditated upon it. As he meditated upon that, which you call Mount Sinai, it's the mountain here, as he looked inside within his own consciousness, and the light became brighter and brighter, then he said, who are thee, Lord? What is your name? And the voice came back from his own inner being saying, I am that I am. You and I are the one, in other words. I am you and you and me. You are light and I am light. We are all light. If you're seeing this, you're seeing the light. Now, it's difficult for Moses to go down and tell the people in captivity that the God name is I am. They would not accept that because they did not have the inner experience that their own God self was functioning in them. They had to have some relationship, something to relate to. So Moses had to come down another level. He had to meet the people at a level that they could communicate with. So he said, Jehovah, the Lord. Yet it shows that even they who lived so long in captivity could not accept Jehovah, Lord. Even when they were led out of the captivity, they had to latch on to some other form to build up devotion. While Moses was up in the mountain trying to bring down more consciousness, the people then chose a form that was obvious. They melted down all the gold and made themselves a golden calf, a form to relate to, because they were so ingrained in their captivity to some form. Finally, when it was all smashed up and the forms were all destroyed, they had to face themselves. So the very first commandment is, thou shalt have no other gods or graven image before me. Me who? Me light. The cosmic principle, the creative intelligence. So the final resume is that when you look inside yourself as a human being, devoid of every religious heritage, since some of us don't want to be affiliated with religious heritages anymore, we want to look at ourselves as human beings, then we have to look at ourselves in the atomic nature now for the first time. We have to accept our atomic structure. If we accept it, then we will see ourselves as pure light. Now, in terms of intimacy in that pure light, you will still have to look at a human being, which is yourself. See? God, though he is impersonal, and though he is permeating you, and you, a human being, would hanker or yearn for intimacy You see? So it is nothing wrong to accept the form of human being. It is not degrading you. In fact, it is extending your comprehension of yourself to see that God is recognizable in human form as an ideal way to relate. It's unimportant if one chooses Jesus, Muhammad, or Buddha, or anyone. The important thing is all will eventually say, I and my Father are one. When it happened to Kabir, Kabir was a saint who lived many years ago, and he had studied all the various religions in the world at the time. He embraced them all. Finally, when the final devotion came for him to practice devotion, one day he woke up out of his meditation and shouted, I am he, I am he. And he ran through the marketplace shouting, I am he. And they all thought he was crazy. Then one priest says, yes, me too. This is true. The final realization is the I am he. We're understanding it deeper every day that realization of God is looking at your higher self. And don't be afraid of it. Yes? I said before, remember the words are very specific, no man has seen his God but has seen his light. Now I'll tell you something else, which is entirely different to what I've said. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word is God, and the Word was made flesh and dwelt in man. That's a big difference than the light. It did not say the light is God. No man has seen God but his light. And I'm saying now that the Word is God. The audible life current, the Shab, or the holy name, or cosmic sound, the divine presence, is God. That is heard, not seen. Big difference. One has to hear God. One may not see God, but see his light. So the sound precedes the light. But God is all music. That's why it's beyond the light. What is beyond the light is this cosmic sound that is responsible for the light being existing. In the highest state of awareness, Anam Loka, where man fully sees God as himself, there he is the eternal sound vibrating. In Anam Lok, it is called the state of the eternal mercy. Without it, there is no compassion, there is no grace. And it's in that state, the unutterable Nam or sound is made audible for man for the first time. And from that state descends light, coming down like a golden rain, causing creation to begin. In the first expression of creation is beingness, acting on beingness. Then the next level down is beingness acting on consciousness. The third level down is consciousness acting on consciousness. The fourth level down is consciousness acting on energy. The fifth level down is energy acting on energy. The sixth level down is consciousness acting on matter. The seventh level down is energy acting on matter. And the final level down is where we are, matter acting on matter. Do you see where you are in creation? But Anam Lok, the eternal mercy, is a pure cosmic audible sound. It is the God process. You call it the Logos, or you call it the Amen, whatever name you want to call it. But it's the audible life current. It's this life, creative intelligence, that is audible for the first time. And it's heard, not seen. The only level you can see it is when it starts to radiate down as light. Therefore, in the pineal gland, the sound is vibrating. At the level of experience, at the point between the eyebrow, it's light. It's shining in the darkness. Turning the senses in and looking in for the first time, that is what we see, the light. But it's not the light that gets us back to God, because the light is not God. The light is the image of God. It's the sound, the actual vibratory power that is God. Through that, we are drawn back up, and we have to experience it. So that's the big difference between the light and the sound. Yes? Master Jesus said, those who have eyes to see, let them see, and ears to hear, let them hear. This is my answer. Yes. If it's interference, there's something beyond it all, and you can hear it right in this room. It's right behind. There's a big difference between hearing and listening. But you can hear it, the audible life current inside. Eastern religion is highly involved in mankind. In fact, there was one scientist who said the Easterner is more materialistic than the Westerner. Because the Westerner is not materialistic, he's spiritual, he destroys everything and hopes God will replace it. But the Easterner is too concerned that destroying anything he can't afford for God to replace it. See? We pollute everything and pray to God to replace it. So that's our Western approach. Our Eastern approach, we dare not destroy anything. We dare not pollute anything because we don't know if he's going to replace it. So who is more materialistic? Well, the involvement, this is what we're talking of, the involvement is not to destroy, is to get into the whole movement. The more we are involved with it, the more we get to touch the thing and handle it and get involved. This is what we're talking. The Eastern teachers came back to the out of their caves to get involved with mankind. This is what they've done. They've come out of their caves and they're involving themselves with mankind. You know, Jesus was an Easterner, you know. He wasn't a Westerner. Did you know that? He was born in the Middle East. So we are kind of afraid to look at the thing about spiritual teachers. All the great teachers of truth were Orientals. We are hoping that the next teacher of truth will be a Westerner. This is not to criticize it. We hope that this will happen. Now, when Ramakrishna was in the body, This was an Eastern teacher. He was the teacher of a man called Swami Vivekananda, who was the first teacher, Indian master, to come to this country at the invitation of the Parliament of Religions. And before he died, his disciples asked him, he said, "Sir, can you tell us where you will be born in your next incarnation?" And they said he looked over the Ganges from the rooftop of the house. And for a long time, then he turned around and he says, "I have not yet visited the West." So Vivekananda understood what that meant, that to lay the groundwork for the master again, or his master, was to come to the West. And the Vivekananda Society, the Vedanta Society, spread a great deal in this country and in Europe, laying the groundwork that someday those students of truth may be the fortunate parent of Ramakrishna whenever he decides to come to the West, or born in the West. We will have many masters born in the West of Caucasian body. Yes.
Is there none already born in the West of the statue of Ramakrishna?
Not yet. We're hoping. Gentleman behind one says something.
Yes.
Life itself. Life makes this rose possible. The vital power of the universe makes this rose possible. Yet this vital power is audible. It can be heard. And it will take the shape of the human voice and communicate to us. Yogananda one time said he was visiting with a saint in India. And while they were meditating, they heard constantly the voice of God talking to the saint. That this audible current was giving out the different levels of consciousness to him. And whenever he asked a question, this audible sound was loud in the room. And at that time, he was not even evolved enough to even to hear it himself. But this was occurring very loud and clear around this saint. Years after, when he was able to listen to the sound within himself and hear it, it began to occur around him. Not too long, I visited with a disciple of his, an American, who knew that the Master Yogananda would go into the back of the garden where he lived in California, and he would tell the disciple, "Don't let no one disturb me." Now the boy knew that there were no other beings back of that garden except Yogananda. So he would stand up there, and between the hedge and Yogananda, he would be there to prevent anyone going into the garden. And he said he heard the voices of saints talking to Yogananda. And some of the voices he recognized, because when Yogananda addressed them as they appeared to him, and the communication went on between the two of them, his human voices were going on. One time he said, he heard Yogananda says, "I'm happy to greet you, O Guru Nanak." And the voice says, "Yes, I'm happy to greet you now, since you've made every effort to come to this level." And many such conversations occurred as saints appeared to him. And this boy was fortunate to hear it. Now he said he could actually describe these voices. They were so resonant and different in every time they spoke. So he heard. Now if he had seen, this would be different too. Now, there was another teacher that came not too long from India, and he was somewhere up back east here, and he was sitting on a rock, and they saw him talking just to the empty tree, between the tree and the rock. So his student ventured to go out and ask him, "Sir, who are you talking to?" And he replied, "I am speaking to Kabir." So the student says, "I don't see him." Well, the teacher said, "All right, you shall have the blessing." And he touched the boy on the head. He not only saw Kabir standing there, but he heard Kabir held a lengthy discourse on the inner realms with the men, on what was going on in the inner realms. And the first time he saw Kabir, he was in doubt of hallucination. He was in doubt that he might be hypnotized by the teacher. It is until a week after, someone had a picture of what Kabir looked like. And it was the same man he had seen. Now, Kabir spoke very thick accent in his language. And those who grew up in the area of where Kabir was supposed to grow up, the boy was fortunate to go back and visit that area in India, and that very area. And he tried to investigate, and they knew of the Saint Kabir where he lived. And they told him, from the language and from the people in that area, they all spoke with the same type of accent. So God is not only light, he is sound. But this is a sound that became flesh, because he said the word became flesh and dwelt in man. This audible life current is in man. We have to make the attempt to get it. Okay. For attending, and my generous host and his wife for having us here, and all the friends. Also, we're looking forward to a few days we're here, and that we're having an initiation. And if the Lord willing, you may show up. Thank you.